Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This year's Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism was awarded to The Guardian's U.S. edition and The Washington Post for their reporting on Edward Snowden's leaks on the NSA surveillance program. It revealed an extensive global surveillance program, including the dragnet collection of telephone metadata. According to the Pulitzer Committee, each organization was awarded journalism's highest honor for its revelation of widespread secret surveillance by the National Security Agency, marked by authoritative and insightful reports that help the public understand how disclosures fit into the larger framework of national security. So, how should we understand these disclosures? It's not easy. And what is the best way to reform a system that a majority of Americans feel violate their privacy? Congress is considering a number of bills that purport to reform the NSA surveillance program. Civil liberties advocates say, with few exceptions, most of them are simply putting lipstick on a pig. So, what kinds of NSA reforms do you want to see? And what's really at stake here? Today, we're joined by Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Trevor is a writer, activist, and legal analyst who specializes in free speech and government transparency issues. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian, and he formerly worked as an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Hi, Trevor. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. And we're also joined by Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist writing about national security and civil liberties. She runs the popular blog Empty Wheel. She also publishes at outlets including The Guardian and Salon. She is author of Anatomy of Deceit, a primer on the CIA leak investigation. She also live blogged the Scooter Libby trial. And she's best known for her analysis of legal documents on counterterrorism programs. Hi, Marcy. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be on with both of you.
Great to have you. So, you know, whenever we do shows on Snowden, I always ask the guests too big of a question, and that is, there's been so much revealed over the past week. Can you give us some context? I know that's such a big question, but Trevor, when you look back at all of the information that has been revealed, what really stands out for you?
Well, I think just the volume of information we've learned. I mean, we've learned more over the past year than we learned in the 10 years previous about what our government is doing behind closed doors. I mean, the stories are almost endless. You know, we know about the phone metadata surveillance program where the NSA is collecting every phone call in the U.S. But then there's also the what's known as the 702 program, which is the FISA Amendments Act, where large portions of our email that we send overseas are being scanned for keywords. Then there's the huge story that I think was really underplayed, which was that the NSA is breaking into the data, the links in between the data centers that Google and Yahoo use overseas. So, you know, we have the NSA on one hand going to the secret FISA court in the U.S. to get large portions of data, but even behind the court's back, they're then going overseas and actually breaking into these companies. So they have both a front door and a back door. And, you know, I think that it really shocked the American public to see not just the amount of surveillance, but the ways that the NSA has gone about it, which has largely been secret, unaccountable, and never voted on by the American public.
Hmm. And Marcy, what about you? What really stands out for you? I mean, it's amazing to look at politicians' quotes on these issues. Like Jimmy Carter, for example, announced that he didn't use email because the NSA could be spying on him. Senator Dianne Feinstein, a longtime supporter of the CIA, charged that the agency was monitoring a congressional investigation. Last year, a federal district court judge in Washington described the surveillance program of Orwellian. I mean, so much has come out since then, and so many opinions have changed. What really stands out for you?
Three things. I mean, one is what Trevor was kind of getting at, but the program names kind of serve to obscure, is that underlying it all is this notion that you're going to collect it all, and then you are going to use that data to create what Edward Snowden, in a recent appearance in Europe, called fingerprints. Excuse me. That are very rich dossiers of people who may or may not have any tie to terrorism or hacking or what have you. Collected all very detailed dossiers, fingerprints of people, and all that before you get to understanding what the government then does with it. This is just the NSA. We haven't seen how the FBI uses the stuff that the NSA collects, and the government is very purposely hiding that in court cases. So we're just seeing, you know, kind of, we're looking through Edward Snowden's slats through a blind, and we're not even seeing anything about how it gets from these giant computers in Maryland to a Muslim kid being stopped in Portland.
What is it like to try to get that information as a journalist? What are the challenges involved in that?
Well, I mean, there's an unbelievable amount of data out there, and it takes a lot of time to go read through and reread through to understand what we've learned. And then, and this is something I'm trying to do now, is then you have to go at it from the other side and say, well, we know this guy was identified via these programs. How did you get from point A to point B? Because the government's not going to give us that information. So you have to work at it from many different sides.
And Trevor, go ahead, yeah.
Well, I think what's been striking is how the government has tried to shield itself from accountability. When we think of secrecy, we really have to think of it as kind of an immunity trump card that they've been playing for the past 10 years. You know, just a few months before these disclosures came out, the ACLU was in the Supreme Court challenging the FISA Amendments Act, which is one of the two laws that has one of the two main laws that has been of so much controversy in the past 10 months. And the Supreme Court dismissed their case without ever getting to the merits. They said that the plaintiffs, which were journalists and human rights workers, didn't have standing because they couldn't prove that the surveillance was happening. And one of the main reasons that the government was able to get the case dismissed before having the merits ruled on was that the Solicitor General told the Supreme Court justices that if this type of surveillance was ever used against a defendant, the defendant that would be notified and have a chance to challenge it in court. Well, it turned out that the Solicitor General actually unwittingly lied to the Supreme Court. His national security team had told him something that plainly wasn't true, that they actually weren't telling any defendants for years that the surveillance was going on, and there was actually no way for anybody to challenge the constitutionality of the law. And so, you know, now what we're seeing is the government is reluctantly at least telling defendants parts of what they're doing, but it's like pulling teeth.
Some defendants,
and
not everybody even. I mean, there are plenty of defendants we know, or people who are now in prison, we know who were caught using these programs, and they've never gotten notice. And the government is now saying it doesn't have to give notice on the 215 program at all. So they're not even fulfilling kind of what Verrilli mistakenly claimed they were doing yet, still.
And Marcy, we're going to talk about some of the proposals on the table to address these concerns. But when we talk about reforming the CIA and reining in the surveillance state, what do we mean exactly? Because it sounds like a massive, massive undertaking.
Sorry, you mean the NSA, right?
Yeah, the NSA.
Yeah, the CIA is something entirely different.
No, yes.
I'm, long list of that
thank
too.
You. I meant the NSA, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing you got to do is get the NSA to move away from this collected all mentality to a more targeted mentality, whether it's for, you know, collecting against terrorists, collecting, you know, hacking people, whether it's collecting vulnerabilities to weaken the internet to make sure that they can get in the future. I mean, all of these things are this kind of massive approach, this everything approach, and I think that the underlying principle for reforming the NSA needs to be targeting. We're not saying don't spy, we're saying target, you know, do what you need to do, not everything. Because you're never going to understand everything, so why bother anyway? Mm. It's just going to prevent you from seeing threats.
And Trevor, what would you say to that? When we talk about reforming the NSA, what do we mean exactly?
Well, I think that's an important point that Marcy just made, and it's a point that Edward Snowden actually himself has made over and over again. You know, it's not like he wants to blow up the NSA or disband it or anything like that. He thinks that they should get back to what they're supposed to be doing, which is targeted surveillance of individuals, which we have reason to believe are engaged in terrorism, rather than this collect information on millions of tens of millions of people that are innocent and have never even considered committing a crime. And unfortunately, the NSA, for the past decade at least, has been engaged in this type of suspicionless mass surveillance without any democratic process whatsoever. And, you know, there are at least one bill in particular that's on the table that has a good chance of passing that could at least rein in some of the NSA's capabilities. It's called the USA Freedom Act. And it was actually written by the author of the Patriot Act, James Sensenbrenner, who no one has ever considered or accused of being a civil libertarian. He's a Republican from Wisconsin, and he wrote the law that so many people had a problem with 10 years ago. But what it went much, much farther than he even imagined, and he's been outraged since he found out about the secret interpretation, which allows the NSA to collect all of this data. And he, the USA Freedom Act would bring more transparency to the NSA, would reform the FISA court so we would get to know what the court is, at least the major opinions that they write, we would get to find out about them. And it would also rein in at least some of the mass surveillance the NSA is doing. You know, the bill actually probably has enough votes to pass the House right now. Unfortunately, the House leadership actually refuses to bring it to the floor. So it remains to be seen if we'll actually get a vote on this bill.
And the USA Freedom Act is being embraced by a number of civil liberties groups, including the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They have said that it would actually result in a real change to NSA surveillance. If passed, according to the EFF, this bill would be a substantial improvement to the country's laws regarding mass surveillance. It brings new levels of transparency, as you said, to the FISA court, introduces a special advocate to champion civil liberties to the court, and appears to create new statutory limits on mass surveillance by the NSA. Marcy, what are your thoughts on the USA Freedom Act?
I think it's by far the best proposal on the table. You know, basically, the other efforts to quote-unquote reform still aspire to collect a lot of data on completely innocent people, and in many cases to search it, to search the content without reasonable suspicion or any suspicion. So, you know, I think the USA Freedom Act is the one proposal on the table that would really improve this, because it really gets at that bulk collection that both Trevor and I have been talking about.
And the EFF says the USA Freedom Act does not deal with problems like NSA programs to sabotage encryption standards. It does not effectively tackle the issue of collecting information on people outside the U.S., and it doesn't address the authority that the government is supposedly using to tap the data links between service provider centers, such as those owned by Google and Yahoo.
Yeah, you know, I think the Freedom Act should be looked as kind of a floor for reform. Not necessarily the ceiling. There's definitely things in the bill, or there's things that a lot of people would like in the bill that aren't in the bill, and that this is, the reform process will probably be very long, and, you know, it shouldn't be seen as a be-all, end-all if the USA Freedom Act is ever passed, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
And Marcy, what would you add there?
Oh, yeah, I agree with everything Trevor says. I think some of the reform we're going to bring to the NSA will be brought about by things like embracing more encryption, and Trevor's organization has been at the forefront of doing that. Because if more people encrypt their communications, if more service providers encrypt everything, then the NSA is going to have to do this more targeted approach, because they can't do this bulk collection, or at least not given the technology now. I would say there is this risk, as there always is when you are legislating the executive branch's ability to surveil Americans or surveil generally, is that they'll take their toys and go home. In other words, that, you know, given the technology, given the way the internet is structured, it would be very easy for them, and there are reasons to believe they may already be doing some of this, to just move everything outside of the structure of the law. So in other words, if USA Freedom Act says you can't collect bulk under Section 215, then some of that data the government can get overseas, and they can just say, well, you know, we're collecting overseas, so it doesn't come under the, you know, under the control of Congress or the FISA court or what have you. But that's part of the difficulty of trying to rein in the surveillance, because the government is going to do what it wants to do unless you put real limits across, and really very explicit limits on what it is permitted to do.
That is Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist writing about national security and civil liberties. She runs the popular blog Empty Wheel, and she's author of Anatomy of Deceit, a primer on the CIA leak investigation. We're also joined by Trevor Tim, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian, and he specializes in free speech and government transparency issues. And today we are talking about privacy and surveillance in the post-Snowden era. How have all of these revelations changed your views on privacy and surveillance? And when we talk about reform, what does that mean to you, and what reforms would you like to see? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you have any questions at all about the revelations, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in these fields of privacy or in technology, how are you putting all of this into context? And how do you think we should strike a balance between privacy and national security issues? And if you're supporting any of these proposals, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Going back again to the USA Freedom Act, the EFF says that the bill does not hold public officials accountable for their role in allowing the spying to take place and hiding it from the public and from Congress. That's interesting, Trevor. What would that look like to hold public officials accountable in this case? Like, who would be held accountable?
Well, I think what they might be talking about is the fact that, for the last 8 years, this is actually the second NSA scandal since 9/11. The first back in the Bush administration in 2005 and 2006, when the New York Times and the USA Today first revealed that the NSA was warrantlessly wiretapping people inside the United States and collecting all of this telephone metadata. There has been various lawsuits going on trying to hold public officials accountable. And every time, it seems that the government is able to get these lawsuits dismissed on technicalities and procedural maneuvers and never actually getting to the merits of the case, which is whether or not this is actually unconstitutional. They often use the state secrets privilege, saying that even if this even though we've read about this on the front pages of the newspapers, it can't be litigated in court, even if all the allegations are true, because it's too secret and shouldn't be public. They've used something called sovereign immunity, which basically gives immunity to the government at large because there wasn't explicit admission in the original FISA bill that would allow them to be sued. And we talked about earlier about the ACLU's case and the fact that it was dismissed on standing grounds and rather than on the merits. And so we've seen this time and time and again where they've been able to avoid accountability for their unconstitutional actions. And I think what the EFF would like is for these bills to be written in a way that would allow people more easily to challenge these laws and to sue if they are violated.
Do you think the public at large really understands what's going on here?
Well, I think they do more than they did 10 months ago. Go ahead, Marcy. Sorry.
I think that the NSA always keeps saying, you guys aren't having your content collected, and that's not actually true. I mean, there is a great deal of content, as Trevor said, that gets scanned that may or may not look like foreign content. It gets scanned as it purportedly moves into the country. There is a great deal of content that gets collected incidentally. There's a great deal of U.S. person content that gets collected overseas. We don't know how much. Again, partly because even when asked by the FISA court, the government has claimed to be unable to answer how many U.S. persons, how many Americans and permanent residents are being affected by this. So, I think they get that point, and I think they get the point that it's out of that there aren't sufficient, there's not sufficient oversight. Congress isn't doing the job that they need to do. The FISA court just really isn't structured to do the job that they need to do, and our legal system isn't doing the job that it needs to do to allow defendants to challenge these things. So, I think they get sort of the idea, and maybe not quite And frankly, I'm not sure that they understand what, say, Google collects on them or what Facebook. And it's a similar kind of question that I think people need to be a lot more aware of all of the data that's being collected on them. You know, Google collects a ton, and everything Google collects, the NSA can get.
Well, elaborate on that a bit, because I find that I'm not hearing as many people talking about these issues. I don't see many posts on Facebook anymore. Do you think it's because people feel helpless about what they can do about it, or do they feel like they're not being spied on, and so why should they worry? What are your thoughts, Marcy?
I think it's probably some of both. I think the ways in which average people are going to get sucked in, you know, if you're a Muslim, you need to be concerned. And let's be totally honest. If you know people who could be defined as hackers, you need to be concerned. I think that people don't imagine other ways they might be sucked in. So, for example, yesterday the White House cybersecurity person said these are the times when we would use a vulnerability. And one of the things he said they would use it for, is to search for people violating intellectual property laws. So, you know, if you download illegal movies online, you need to be concerned about this, because that's something the NSA is doing and not talking a lot about doing.
Hmm. What are your thoughts, Trevor?
Well, I think people have, you know, over the last 10 months, they've heard a lot of stories, and it's possible that they have become numb to them. And, you know, I think we're also in kind of this lull right now where there hasn't been as many stories coming out because The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald, and Laura Poitras's new organization is just ramping up, and so there hasn't been as many stories. And that in the legislative process, it seems to have stalled to the point where these bills aren't being actively debated in committee, and the ones that potentially could go to the floor could make things worse. For example, the Intelligence Committee bill that is chaired by Mike Rogers actually would allow for more collection or more types of collection of U.S. persons' data than is allowed under current law. You know, I think things will ramp up, though. You know, we have to remember that the Patriot Act power that has allowed the phone surveillance program to go on is up for renewal next year, and the Congress will have to do something one way or another, whether it's renew this bill or just get rid of it entirely or reform it. And so there's no way that they can avoid that debate. It may take a while. Hopefully something will happen before then. Hopefully this will become an election issue this year for midterms. But, you know, it's not going away anytime soon completely, that's for sure.
Trevor Timm is co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Marcy Wheeler is an independent journalist writing about national securities and civil liberties at the blog Empty Wheel. And today we are talking about privacy and surveillance in the post-Snowden era and what reform would actually look like. It's been almost a year since we've had these revelations. And what are your thoughts on this? Are you finding that people are still talking about this issue? Are you still thinking about this issue? How have these revelations changed your views on privacy and surveillance? Marcy just said that Muslims, hackers, and those who download movies and music and content illegally need to be very concerned about this. So if you fall into those categories, are you concerned about this? And then when we talk about reforming the NSA, what do we really mean when we say that? And what would reform actually look like? We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that, at 1, This American Life with Ira Glass. Pardon me, at noon, it's This American Life with Ira Glass. And at 1, Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will celebrate California Bookstore Day by speaking with the owners of independent bookstores. We'll talk with Green Apple, Walden Pond, and Bookshop Santa Cruz. What is your favorite bookstore? What does your bookstore add to your community? And what do we lose when they disappear? That's tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the NSA surveillance program leaks. It's been a year since Edward Snowden leaked information to Glenn Greenwald of The Guardian. Despite widespread privacy concerns, not a single bill has passed to reform the NSA. So what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the public still cares about this issue? Do you care about it? Do you understand what all of this means, given all the revelations we've seen over the last year? How do you think this affects you? And when you think about reforms, what kinds of reforms would you like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. I don't hear many people talking about these issues anymore. So what are your thoughts on this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What about some of the other proposals on the table? What about the FISA? The other thing is, I don't think people know what FISA even means outside of civil liberties circles. But there's the FISA Transparency and Modernization Act. It was written by the chairs of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, a Republican from Michigan, and Dutch Ruppersberger, a Democrat from Maryland. The EFF says this act creates a new surveillance regime while again making only minimal changes to Section 215. This is the part of FISA that allows for bulk collection of telephone metadata. Trevor, how do you describe FISA? Like when you're at a family holiday gathering or something and a relative says they don't know what that means, how do you describe it? Trevor?
The FISA, yeah.
Go ahead.
The FISA court was established 40 years ago. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people don't even know it exists. You know, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court is what it stands for. And, you know, it was originally developed as actually a reform for surveillance that was going on in the 60s and 70s under the Nixon administration. And what it did was allow the U.S. government to get warrants for individuals in a secretive process. But the court really transformed after 9/11. Before it was just granting individual warrants or rejecting them. I mean, they didn't reject them very often or hardly at all, but in 99% of the cases, they would accept them. But what they ended up doing was turning into this kind of shadow Supreme Court where they were writing these sweeping opinions that affected everybody, not just somebody, one person or two people under investigation, but the entire United States, and creating this secret body of Fourth Amendment law that people had no idea was affecting them. And the real problem with this court is, number one, it's inherently secret. We never find out about the opinions we never found out about opinions until 6 months ago. And now we've just found out about opinions that ruled stuff unconstitutional, years ago, and the fact that all of these opinions are really affecting every American. And, you know, the government is making these arguments in secret. There is nobody opposing them. So basically the court is adopting whatever the government argues, and often what the government argues goes against American values of privacy and the right to be left alone if you didn't do anything wrong or aren't suspected of doing anything wrong. And, it's inherently undemocratic and un-American what's going on in the FISA court, and it is a shame that more people don't know about it.
So, Marcy, what are your thoughts on this FISA Transparency and Modernization Act?
Trevor mentioned earlier that it would actually expand surveillance in some ways, and that's an important point. Right now, the only domestic FISA-related bulk collection, I should never say only when I'm talking about the NSA, but the one that everyone is talking about involves our phone records. We had to shut down an internet one because they couldn't do it legally and effectively. It got shut down for about a year and then turned back on, and then NSA realized that once they started doing it legally, it could no longer be effective. What the program actually does is move the collection to the provider, so to Verizon, for example, And that gives them a way around some of the laws that are causing them problems, probably not just on internet content, but probably even on location, that they'll be able to play with that data and not, quote-unquote, collect it into the government's hands and therefore get to play with it. The other really alarming part of that is that it provides for the NSA providing assistance, on-site assistance, to the providers. And that's sort of necessary because to do what they do, somebody needs to go in and play with the raw data. But that means there would be NSA people, or probably contractors, living at Verizon playing with our Verizon data. And that should be, you know, it's the same, because the functions are the same, it's the same frightening structure, but now we've got NSA in the front door of the telecoms, or at least permitted by the law. So, you know, there are things like that, and fundamentally it doesn't stop what the program does, which is collect people. I had said earlier that Muslims and hackers and people who download illegal content need to be concerned, but really it's people who are 2 degrees away from those people. So if there's reason to suspect you, I call it 3 degrees of Osama bin Laden. If through 3 connections you can be, or 2 now, you can be tied to somebody that the government might deem suspicious, your call records can get sucked up in this program and, you know, basically thrown into the bowels of the NSA. And the language that the court documents use say the NSA can use the full extent of its analytical tradecraft. Once it gets into the NSA, they can do whatever they do. Including data mining, including mapping your identities, including potentially even doing backdoor searches on content to get your content. So so that's part of the point, is innocent people should not be thrown into the dragnet like that, and they still would be.
Well, we have a related question from Lee, who says, could we have a hypothetical where seemingly innocuous information leads to legal problems? Marcy,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and can you give us some examples, because I know this is happening.
Well, I mean, just as an example, the Center for Constitutional Rights has a brand new lawsuit for people who got put on the no-fly list and then coerced to become informants on their community. They're all Muslims. And at least one of them, the FBI asked, they said, did you read this sermon online? And he said, yes. And it's clear that reading something online is one of the things that this guy sucked into the dragnet. We're supposed to be allowed to read even horrible content in this country, but that's sort of the point I made earlier, is we know the NSA does this stuff, and we know what happens to people on the outside, that, you know, people start going after them with informants, their content gets collected, they get put on no-fly lists. We don't see, you know, how you get from point A to point B. But we know that does happen. We know that people who, because their online profile looks suspicious, end up not being able to, you know, do their job anymore because they can't lie to it.
That is Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist writing about these issues on her popular blog, Empty Wheel. She's author of Anatomy of Deceit. And Trevor Tim is co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian. And it's been a year since Edward Snowden's NSA surveillance program leaks were published by Glenn Greenwald in The Guardian. So how have these revelations changed your views on privacy and surveillance? Is this something that you think about as much as you did when all of this was leaked? Are you hearing people talk about it? How do you make sense of all of it? Because it is, it's a lot. I mean, so much has been revealed, and so much more will definitely be revealed in the months to come. What reforms would you like to see? And do you believe that we will see reforms? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for your email, Lee. Let's hear from Rich in San Francisco. Hi, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I don't have anything intelligent to say, except that from the people I talk to, and I'm including people who I would classify as very liberal and civil libertarian types, they like me, begin to feel that the whole process of reform is somewhat futile. And the powers, the system of our government, I hate to sound horribly paranoid about the whole thing, but everything just kind of works against it. So you have a few people crying out. You have a lot of people that are just bemoaning the situation, but just kind of say, well, I just got to accept the fact that this is going to go on. I keep writing to my senators, and I get no encouragement, obviously, from them, and I don't see any encouragement from Congress. The telecoms seem to work closely with the government and have long had a cozy relationship. They're great lobbies. You know, in terms of reform, I think you would need something very fundamental that just goes to a basic concept like you own your data and you have access to the courts to protect it. But the only time when the EFF and others tried to go to court, they got tossed out. I guess the lawsuit is probably still alive in some fashion. It seems to be just kind of a catch-22 all the time with some of the reasoning of the court. But anyway, that's... You know, it's just hard to be optimistic.
Hmm.
So
Rich,
I've had more than my fair share of time.
Well, yeah. Rich, do people in your circles still talk about this issue?
Well, they do, and I talked to a guy yesterday who was a major landlord, and he's now using Tor. Somehow, he did have a beard, so he may be a terrorist. But otherwise, you know, he's taking some precautions, and... You know, I don't happen to carry, you mentioned, I don't carry my cell phone with me. It's actually a flip phone, mm-hmm. not even a smart one. I see no reason to carry a tracking device with me.
Yeah.
Not that anybody would want to track me. I'm not doing anything, but I just don't like it.
Yeah.
It's amazing that people will say that they have nothing to fear from the government, but you start taking a picture of somebody in public and you'll see that they protect their privacy from people and they don't like it.
Mm.
But
well,
thank
you so much, Rich. And we're actually going to be joined by journalist Julia Angwin in the next couple of weeks, who wrote a really good book about how difficult it is to remain private. And we will talk with her about steps we can take to try to keep some of our information private anyway. So thank you for calling. Let's go next to Chris Conway, calling in from the ACLU of Northern California. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
So I think, you know, ACLU has been very concerned about this, and Trevor and Marcy have very well covered some of our concerns with the NSA, but one of the other points I want to make is that we've been seeing surveillance happen not just at the federal government level, but from local governments as well. We have police departments using a device called a Stingray, which is essentially a fake cell tower, and doing everything they can to hide that fact, not only from the public, but even from judges and courts. We've seen more and more data being collected by fusion centers and, you know, ALPRs, automated license plate recognition systems, used to track individuals who are attending rallies or mosques or going back to the Muslim community.
Hmm.
And so I think one of our real concerns is that we have to address the pervasive idea that government access to information can do these wonderful things without side effects, not just from the top down at the federal level, but working in the local communities to change the mentality of individuals are in charge of their government. Government responds to individuals rather than government is the boss.
How should we keep track of surveillance at the local level and surveillance in our communities?
I mean, as people and callers have said, it's difficult to get a response from people in Congress, but we usually have a better access to our local lawmakers, our city council or our board of supervisors, and pressuring them to actually require local law enforcement to be transparent about what tools they're using, to go through, you know, the process of public comment and evaluation of any kind of new surveillance technology. These kind of steps can really, you know, engage in a dialogue around what are you going to use, what is it you're proposing, what do you think the benefits will be, what are the costs going to be, not just that law enforcement identifies themselves, but that the community sees, and then how can you flesh out policies to make sure that if you do go forward with this, you're respecting the rights and liberties of all the individuals in the community rather than focus solely on one particular positive and ignoring all the potential harm.
And Chris, what would you say to people? I just got a post on Facebook that says from Carrie, as the internet evolved, I had a realization that privacy truly no longer exists. If you truly want privacy, unplug and find an off-the-grid cabin somewhere in the woods. I mean, what would you say to that? And then also, do you think that, I mean, obviously this is not getting as much attention as it did when it first broke, but do you find that people are still concerned and are still talking about these issues?
I mean, I think certainly our understanding of privacy is evolving, but people's responses to, let's say, Google Glass show that people are still concerned about privacy. They still want, you know, some kind of contextual control over their information. the fact that there are more cameras and there are more devices does not mean that I am perfectly happy that anyone can look for my name and find out everything I've done or every rally I've attended or every prescription medicine I purchased or all sorts of information that potentially could be collected by someone. That doesn't mean that it's no longer private and is fair game to anyone. So that's kind of the paradigm we're seeing. Rather than privacy being about it's secret and no one knows, privacy is much more about control and the ability to understand it and contextualize information so that you have, you can control what you're sharing with whom, use technology, engage in the modern world without surrendering the ability to actually define yourself. In terms of are people still concerned about this, as people said, it does ebb and flow. And we are looking at the Patriot Act reauthorization, and there are bills in Congress, and there are more and more stories at the local level. Fortunately, we've seen this is, privacy has been an issue that we've been concerned about for a decade, and the Snowden revelations have been a much stronger push than anything else we've ever seen. This is many months of stories, many months of attention. It's natural that it's ebbing a little bit, but there is still more awareness today than there was a year ago of the issues of privacy and surveillance.
Right, and The Guardian said it's leaked a tiny percentage, about 5 to 10% of the Snowden revelations, so who knows what else we're going to get in the coming months.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's Chris Conway of the ACLU in Northern California. And today we're joined by Trevor Timm, co-founder and executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and Marcy Wheeler, an independent journalist writing about these issues on her popular blog, Empty Wheel. And she's author of Anatomy of Deceit. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. It's been nearly a year since we've read about the NSA surveillance program and read all the leaks. So how have these revelations changed your views on privacy, and what reforms would you like to see? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Back in 2007, I think it was the Electronic Frontier Foundation broke the story of Mark Klein, the AT&T technician who leaked the secret documents that AT&T allowed the NSA to install a secret room that literally vacuumed up all internet and telephone traffic from a San Francisco location. And this covered either the whole United States or the Western United States. I believe Congress, if I remember the history right, and especially Senator Dianne Feinstein, forgave the telephone companies for violating the wiretap laws, which no one seems to mention anymore because wiretap laws required having a warrant to search communications. So we were kind of told that that was a one-time event, and they were being forgiven in the name of, the war on terror and 9/11 and all that. And so now we have something that's far more insidious, and yet I think that the problem with some of the messaging, I don't know if you'd say from progressives or from the media, is that they're not citing a specific example of, Mrs. Murphy talking about her cow, and they vacuumed this up, and because she used the word bomb, that it's being used against her. I'm wondering if they search for keywords, and I feel like the messaging is so mixed, people feel like, well, what are we going to do?
Marcy, what are your thoughts on that? And are they using keywords?
They're not using keywords.
Oops. You know what, Marcy? They might be using keywords for you because your cell phone just went really bad. Maybe we'll try to get you on another line. Trevor, do you know if they're using keywords?
Well, there is one of the most important stories that come out of this whole Snowden all of the Snowden revelations actually wasn't necessarily found in the Snowden documents, but was something the New York Times reporter Charlie Savage reported, which was that the government was actually scanning large portions of email going overseas or coming from overseas to the United States. And so normally when, we think of what the government can search when it comes to Americans and their communications, We think that they would need a warrant with individualized suspicion, meaning that, that they name the individual that they're searching for and that they have reason to believe this person is doing something wrong. But in this case, the government was just indiscriminately trying to suck up as many emails as they could to find out if there were certain email addresses or names or dates or code words being emailed overseas. And, you know, I think this is a real problem when we talk about Americans' privacy and the fact that, you know, we have laws in this country that should prevent this. You know, I don't think that they're using keywords in the sense of, you know, every time you Google something that something gets triggered. You know, the fact remains that the NSA is using all of their vast powers to really ride on the edge of the law, and there's very little that you can do on the internet that you can't get sucked up into their dragnet one way or another.
But when you do search, it does show up in other places. So, for example, I mean, it can be obviously innocuous, but if you're planning a trip and you search on Google, a hotel ad for that place will come up on Facebook. Right? So a lot of it is intertwined.
Yeah, and that's cookies.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we know they're collecting are those cookies. Mm-hmm. They consider that part of metadata. And so when I said earlier that they're putting together these kind of dossiers or these fingerprints of people who might be completely innocent, that's the kind of thing they're attaching. So they'll attach that cookie, and that's how your web browser tracks that you are going to Boston, for example. Mm. They'll tie that cookie to your email address and to your phone number, and then you are, you know, this user who is on a trip to Boston. So that's how they figure that stuff out.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ken. Let's go to another Ken in Sunnyvale. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I'm sort of trying to answer your question about whether, like, the average person, the average citizen is concerned about privacy. And I'm just sort of an average, you know, California liberal. Everybody, 95% of the people I know are in the Democratic Party, probably more than 95%. We all consider ourselves liberal. We, you know, in regard to gay rights, legalizing marijuana. And of all the people I know, no one is concerned about this issue of privacy.
Hmm.
And I just think, I know it's on news media all the time, and it's been on KQED, on forum a lot, and it's all over the news media. And I know it seems like it's a big issue if you just do a search of it, but as far as the average person is concerned, I just don't think there's any real concern about privacy.
Well, I'm so glad you called in with that, Ken. Why do you think that is? I mean, do you ever ask your friends why it's not concerning to them?
Well, it's never come up, but my wife and I have talked about this. And one thing is this. I know one of the concerns is that they're doing this sort of vacuum cleaner sweep of all the data and all the phone calls made, and people think that's unnecessary. But the best example I can think of is the Sarnoff brothers in Boston. They were completely under the radar of the CIA, the NSA, and everybody else. Nobody knew they were terrorists. They certainly didn't appear to be terrorists. One's just a young college kid who's friendly and bubbly and outgoing and doesn't appear to have whatever a terrorist is supposed to look like or something. Anyway, when those bombings occurred, if the government hadn't been tracking all their phone calls, they would have no idea what happened. But once the bombings occurred and they were determined to be the perpetrators, at that point the government goes back and they can find phone calls that were made by the Sarnoff brothers, and they might, and I have to underline the word might, but they might be able to make a connection with other terrorists in the United States, other terrorists elsewhere. And my point is that they could never do that if they weren't collecting all the data from everyone. If they only collected data from people who appeared to be guilty, they would not have collected, or who appeared to be possible terrorists, then they never would have collected the data from the Sarnoff brothers. And that's just one of many examples where you have to collect all the data because you don't know who is going to end up being a terrorist. And even if 99.99999% of the data is just irrelevant emails, you know, taking my cat to the veterinarian or something, nevertheless, you'd have to collect all the data, because when the terrorists come out of the woodwork, you find out it wasn't somebody you suspected.
So. Well, thanks for calling in, Ken. Ruth-Ann, we don't have time to take your call, but kind of related question, what is your reaction to people who, and we've asked this so many times, say, I shouldn't be worried because I'm not doing anything wrong. But Marcy, what are your thoughts on Ken's comments?
Really important points, and you know, I think he represents an important viewpoint. About the Tsarnaev brothers, I would say, A, the way they collect data, they actually may have thrown away data that's some of the most important in that investigation, because to do the mapping that they do, they have to take out things like pizza joints. And there was actually a pizza joint that's probably central to what the brothers were doing over the last several years. So it's not clear that it works. But it also, just today, the Inspector General from the intelligence community said, well, yeah, there were forensics that eventually would have led us to Kremlin Tsarnaev, the things he was reading, the things he was downloading, but it didn't. And you can look at, for example, the Undi bomber in 2009 and Nidal Hassan in 2009. Both had extensive conversations or had meaningful conversations with Anwar al-Awlaki online, who the FBI had a full-time wiretap on, and they weren't discovered. And part of the reason they weren't discovered is because the FBI agents who were reading that wiretap had so much to do. They had so many pieces of hay in haystack that they couldn't find the needles because they had too much to do. So I think it can work both ways, but what we do know is that in a number of cases, we've had the data, yet the law enforcement and the intelligence community haven't found that needle because we've had too much data to be able to find the needle.
Well, we will continue to follow this issue. Marcy Wheeler is an independent journalist writing about these issues over at Empty Wheel. She's author of Anatomy of Deceit. And Trevor Tim is co-founder of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How are independent bookstores surviving and thriving? On the next Your Call, we'll celebrate California Bookstore Day by talking with the owners of Green Apple Books, Walden Pond Books, and Bookshop Santa Cruz. Independent bookstores are not just stores. They're community centers and local anchors run by passionate readers. So what is your favorite bookstore? What does your bookstore add to your community? And what do we lose when they disappear? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.